Hey, how's it going, everybody? This is Chris. Welcome to episode 5 of She and Titans, where, hey, we're finally here. It's 5 episodes. What am I talking about? You know, here I would say something like, just like I just said, hey, we made it, right? But I feel like I've been starting off just about every episode of this program with something sort of kind of along those lines, mostly out of my own personal surprise that I was able to, you know, get my crap together and put together an episode and actually sit myself behind a microphone and talk into it. But with this issue, with the issue we're going to discuss today, I suppose it feels maybe almost appropriate, purely for my own benefit, that is. You see, this was something I was supposed to do a long time ago. You know, my own personal rules here. I was supposed to write a piece about this issue and maybe even record this episode like a month ago. Well, I mean just shy of a month ago, like 4 weeks ago, we'll say. Clearly, since I'm sitting here doing it now, I did not do it then. It actually took me several weeks to even crack the cover on this one, much less actually sit down and read it. That's more kind of an indictment on my own pseudo-creative baggage than anything else. You see, when you, or I, rather, put a whole lot of eggs in a singular basket, a basket that I fool myself into thinking has any measure of creativity attached to it, you might, or I might, rather, kind of inflate the importance of certain elements of the fake-ass creative process, to the point where, rather than viewing these elements and these steps as though they were, you know, simple hurdles on a running track that I needed to leap every once in a while, they instead become like giant brick walls on the Autobahn. You know, unavoidable, unscalable, and upon impact, wildly and painfully unpleasant, to say the least. In simple terms, I just build things up to the point where they become unbeatable. You know, they become something that I can't do. Now, the book we're about to discuss today, Titans Volume 4, Number 1, it's one I've owned for a little while. It holds the honor of being one of, I don't know, maybe 5 books ever that I purposely double-dipped on. I mean, I've got tons of doubles of comics, but mostly just because of my own poor record-keeping and inability to double-check my collection when I'm in a, you know, bin or something. Now, this one, I already had the book pre-ordered from DCBS, which is usually good enough. But on release day, I found myself suffering from what the kids these days might refer to as a FOMO. Am I too old and uncool to say things like FOMO? Let me know in the comments below. Anyway, I honestly felt as though I'd be missing out not buying this issue on release day, which is weird. It's really weird for me. It's been ages, like literally, since I felt this way. I'm pretty sure the last book I double-dipped on was, it had to have been. I'm trying to think of one in between then and now, and I can't. I think the last book I consciously and purposely double-dipped on was DC Universe Rebirth, way back in, I can't believe 2016 is way back in the day, but time is a cruel thing, isn't it? Now, the plan that day was to be at the shop when it opened, buy the damn thing, take it home, read it, probably twice, write a piece, write a script, and finally, plop my attention-deficient ass behind a microphone. And attention-deficient is a hard thing to say. And, well, I did the first two of those steps. You know, I bought it. I went to the shop, I bought it, and I even bought a variant cover for the issue, though I do have an excuse. Or at least something I tell myself repeatedly so I can sleep at night. You know, I already had cover A pre-ordered from DCBS, right? I already owned it, it was coming, it was set aside, you know, it was done. It's not like I needed two of those, right? So yeah, I bought a variant, and what's worse, or what's more, I should say, I spent $2 extra and bought the $5.99 trading card cover variant. I don't even know who I am anymore. Now, like I said, I never read it. I didn't read it. I actually never even opened the trading card variant. I didn't actually read the issue until several weeks later, when my mail order copy finally showed up. Now, I don't want to get it twisted here. I didn't not read it out of fear that it would be a bad comic. Though, fear did factor greatly into the decision, or non-decision, to not read the book. And, well, it was more a fear of me getting back on the horse. Getting back on the content creation conveyor belt, if you will. I kept asking myself, is this something I really wanted to do? Or had I just kind of fallen back into that bottomless trap of attempting to fill some sort of void in my life with my own poorly written words? And, I don't know, I had to think about that for a long time. Longer than anybody should. And I tell you, I mean, it's pretty sad. And, well, wildly embarrassing that such a benign thing required so much. Or let's be completely honest, any soul-searching. But it did, and I guess that's just who I be. So with that cringy peek behind the curtain out of the way, how about I quit with the vamping, and we finally discuss the book of the hour, which is, again, Titans, Volume 4, Number 1. Had a July 2023 cover date. The story is called Out of the Shadows, written by Tom Taylor with art by Nicola Scott. Oh boy, the art is by Nicola Scott. It is, it's something else. It's really, it's worth the price of admission. Colors, Annette Kwok. Letters, Wes Abbott. Edits, Rosa, Holzer, and Kaminsky, so a different editorial team than Nightwing. Cover price, $4, not $5, though the trading card variant is $6. And this one went on sale May 16th of 2023. All right, now we open with a gunshot, or I guess we open with a bang. Wally West has been shot through the heart, but who is to blame? The Flash thinks to himself how bullets normally ain't no worry for him, ain't no thing, since he's, you know, really, really fast. He can usually deal with oncoming gunfire via his speed and, I guess, vibrational talents. This time, though, not so much. He eventually realizes that his only option at this point is a jog on the old cosmic treadmill. He makes a pit stop through his kitchen in order to tell his family he loves them before hopping on the mill. From here, we shift scenes to a bedroom, where Beast Boy and a shockingly pink-haired Raven are sharing a bed. And he calls her Ray, which, I mean, is short for Raven. I guess it's also short for Rachel. But at first, I didn't realize it was supposed to be Raven. I thought we were getting, like, a really, really, really deep cut. I thought for a second this was going to be, like, Gar's old, like, punk rock girlfriend Jillian. From, like, way back in the ancient long ago. It's not, though. It is in fact, Raven. And I wasn't aware these two were romantically linked. Though, in fairness, I've been away for a while, and at the same time, I didn't know they weren't. So I have zero issue with it. Now, the gimmick here that we don't go into too deeply is that Gar has been having some real bad dreams of late, and has even been shape-shifting into a wee little mouse every night in his sleep. Like I said, we don't learn too much about it. we kind of just find out that it happens, and I'm sure we'll dig into this down the line. It's also worth noting that Gar's eye has somehow healed, or maybe grew back, since last we saw him in Nightwing 104. A handy editorial footnote promises that this will be explained in Tales of the Titans number 4, which I don't think they're talking about the 80s series Tales of the Titans. It's actually a reference to an upcoming miniseries, which means we'll likely see this story in, I don't know, 4 or 5 months. Which, I mean, that's not ideal, but hey, I guess that means we've got at least 4 or 5 months before DC decides to reboot again. So there's that. Anyway, these two chat about how today is the day that the Titans make their new mission statement official. From here, we shift scenes to, well, somewhere wet. You know, somewhere down by the water. Here, we see Dick and Donna trying to recruit Tempest, you know, a Teen Titans original, into their new crew. Garth is, a bit standoffish, kind of bordering on being a dick. He says that he doesn't think the Titans will fill the Justice League shoes. He then, I don't know, for lack of a better term, gets all Namor-y. He complains about how the surface dwellers don't actually care a whole lot about the under the sea. He reveals that not only will he not be joining his old pals, but, well, he's actually already working with somebody else. Somebody who, in his words, can make a real difference. And also, someone who can do what the Titans can't. Please don't be Deathstroke. Please don't be Deathstroke. I feel like every time we get a scene like this, it leads to an inevitable, like, last page reveal of Slade Wilson that we're supposed to be surprised by, and we never really are, because it's always Deathstroke. Anyway, we jump ahead from here, and we're finally back in Bloodhaven, Bloodhaven, for the Titanic PR event. Now, before kicking things off, Dick, for some reason, picks right now to tell Gar and Raven that he's unsure of their sleeping arrangement. As such, he's made sure that they each have their own private quarters inside the new Titans Tower. Which seems to me like, I don't know, kind of an inappropriate or at least, you know, inopportune time and place to be having this little conversation. Doesn't it? I don't know. Like, maybe have this chat before or even after the handful of minutes where the eyes of the world are literally upon them. It feels just a little bit forced to me. Like, even if they have this chat like a minute later when they're inside the tower, at least they don't have everybody staring at them. I don't know. Now, Gar, he thinks it's a good idea for each of them to have their own digs. Raven disagrees. And so the two engage in a bit of a make-out session right then and there in front of everybody. Again, I can't help but to feel that this little, you know, turn of scene is just a little bit forced. Maybe it's just me. Anyway, once the lips are unlocked, it's time for the Titans to officially enter the new Titans Tower for the very first time. Before they can, however, Oracle calls in with a Titans Trouble ticket. You see, we've got us a Category 3 emergency that needs to be dealt with PDQ. Actually, considering what the emergency is, write the F now might be more appropriate. And so Cyborg boom tubes the crew off to a nuclear power plant where Titano the Ape is wrecking more than a little bit of havoc. Like, this could go very, 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 very sideways with the quickness. Which, well, it brings us to the point in the show where I do that Chris thing and raise a very inconvenient point that will completely hinder my ability to just let myself enjoy a story. And I apologize ahead of time. Okay, so we're at a nuclear power plant, right? It's a kind of a big deal. Like, if this goes caca, or caca enough, it could potentially and radically change the world. I mean, we're talking like a cataclysmic event here. Now, we all know that the Justice League are no longer an official unit or entity or whatever. But that doesn't necessarily mean that all the individual members of the former League are in retirement, right? like, here's this nuclear power plant being attacked by a gigantic ape, and we're supposed to believe that Superman's just letting it happen? Like, is Wonder Woman just standing by with a bowl of popcorn? I mean, they're not getting involved? I mean, I know the mission statement of this book and this team is for the Titans to step up and be the new guardians of the planet. Thankfully, not those new guardians, of course. But their being part of a shared universe kind of makes it tough for me to completely buy in on this sort of a scene, right? And I understand and appreciate that the big guns can't be everywhere at once. But I mean, it's a nuclear power plant. And Cyborg, in just a few pages, is going to tell us just how, you know, devastatingly sideways this could have gone. And I mean, none of this is a legit complaint. It's just some of those, if you ever listen to X-Lapsed, we called these Chris problems. So we'll just chalk this one up to that. Just those silly things that dig their way into my lizard brain and sort of, you know, take up residence there. And I mean, to keep going down this rabbit hole for a minute, I suppose Superman and friends not being there could be something that we're supposed to notice. Like, maybe somewhere down the line it'll be a story beat, where maybe we find out that Superman was always, like, just off-panel anytime the Titans dealt with a global threat, right? Just in case they needed him. Maybe even secretly stepping in every now and again to give them some, you know, uncredited assistance. As if to say, this entire time that the Titans were the primary guardians of the planet, well, they were unwittingly and unknowingly working with a net. I don't know, I suppose it could potentially lead to some interesting discussions down the line about trust, and might lead to some generational schism. Whether or not that's a good thing or a bad thing, I don't know. Or maybe I'm just an idiot who's thinking way, way, way too hard about something that doesn't require much thought at all. Anyway, back to the story. Now here, Gar takes the opportunity to transform into a giant Tamaranian kaiju so we can get a cute pseudo-Godzilla vs. King Kong sort of scene. Which also kind of pulls me out of the story, but in a good way. When I first saw this page, I caught myself staring. This, to me, is one of those scenes which really illustrates, no pun intended, what a ridiculously talented and versatile artist we have on this book. I can't say enough good things about the art. I mean, I thought Nicola was unbelievable back on the pre-Flashpoint Teen Titans book, and she's somehow even better now. I mean, it's so good I'm almost getting mad at it. It's really, like I said at the start, it's probably worth the price of admission on its own. It's some fantastic stuff. Anyway, Gar does his thing, and he preoccupies Titano, which facilitates the rest of our Titans performing their roles in thwarting this potential cataclysm. Now, most of the team are focused on scooping up as many civvies as possible, which is wise, of course. And Cyborg is, he's headed directly into the core of the place. Now, upon seeing the state that it's currently in, Vic suggests that this could be, quote, one of the most destructive nuclear events in history, unquote. And again, lizard brain kicking in here. I gotta ask, where's Superman? Where's Wonder Woman? Where are the big guns at? I don't know. Anyway, Cyborg, it turns out, he's so good at doing what it is he does that, well, he does it off-panel. You know, the nuclear bada-bing ain't gonna go ca-ca no more, and the world is once again safe. The book that we're reading, however, is anything but. As off on the horizon, everybody's current year favorite, Peacemaker, is about to make an appearance. Now, full disclosure to any potential new listeners, and a friendly reminder to those who are already familiar with one of my more annoying POVs as a comic book fan. I am a cinematic universe denier. It doesn't exist to me. I have zero use for any of that crap. I know that Peacemaker is now some sort of funny ha-ha played by John Cena. I know he's been made into something of a big deal with the movies and TV projects. Hell, I know I personally bought the first issue of Peacemaker Tries Hard because it had a cute dog on the cover. But he's still gonna be something of a hard sell for me. Not a complaint, just another Chris problem. A funny story, well, I mean, not a funny story, but in all of my years doing Chris's on Infinite Earths, there was only one comic that I read in order to write a post about it that I was so dreadfully bored with that I noped out before publishing it. And that was an issue of Peacemaker from Charlton Comics before the goof became a DC character. It was a Peacemaker number 5, November 1967, cover date by Joe Gill and Pat Boyette, to be exact. So, well, there's a little bit of a Chris's on Infinite Earth's lost media for you. A half-written, wildly disinterested piece on a late Silver Age Peacemaker comic. That was probably printed on the same press as cereal boxes. So yeah, this guy's going to be a tough sell for me. I just hope he doesn't overstay his welcome. So okay, let's get back to it. Peacemaker, he arrives amid a gaggle of choppers, and upon landing he orders that Titano be killed. The Titans step in to prevent this since, you know, everything's kinda kosher now, but we're still dealing with a nuclear power plant. So the good guys just beat the baddie down until he drops, and then they get him as far enough away from the plant as to prevent any potential big booms should any, I don't know, unexpected shoes drop, right? Now, it probably goes without saying, especially for those familiar with the current year take on Peacemaker, but he's kind of a dick. He comes across to me as a sort of like a 1980s Guy Gardner on steroids. You know, the might makes right sort of straw man caricature of a Ronald Reagan voter, who the writers would always portray as like the biggest asshole in any room he's in. I mean, it's to the point where Donna suggests that Peacemaker, and not the, you know, giant monkey who was literally seconds away from triggering one of the most destructive nuclear events in history, might be the worst monster they have to face today. Oy, I mean, just listen to yourself, Donna. Maybe do yourself a favor and take a few days break from social media and then check back in with us. Anyway, from here, Peacemaker approaches Nightwing and says that the President of the United States would like to speak with him and the Titans about working with the U.S. government. Because that's always the story we want to see in comics, right? That always works so well. Thankfully, and unsurprisingly, Nightwing turns down the offer. The Titans, as we know, will be working in service of the entire planet and not in the interests of a singular nation. Peacemaker warns that this is a one-time offer, and he even goes as far as to suggest that the fact that the Titans exist in the first place is enough to get under the skin of some of the power players in the U.S. government. After a polite go-F yourself, the Titans boom tube back home. Now, once they're gone, we learn that Peacemaker is working with Amanda Waller. I mean, like, no duh, right? I don't know if that's supposed to be a reveal or... We'll talk more about that later. Let's instead jump to our final scene of the issue, where the Titans return back to Bloodhaven, Bloodhaven, and finally enter the new tower. Once inside, they're greeted by a trail of bloody and familiar footprints. Our heroes follow the prints downstairs, only to discover the possibly dead body of the Flash. All of the monitors and screens in the room turn on, and we see a simple two-word message. Solve it. And that is where we leave it. Our next issue blurb promises Brother Blood, who, well, ain't one of my favorites. Though in fairness, neither was Neron, and Tom managed to make that work. So, fingers crossed, and we'll worry about that next time. But for now, let's talk about this one. I think I would say that this issue falls comfortably in the same pile as the rest of the issues we've been discussing up to this point. Books that I would personally file under pleasantly surprised. You know, not that I had much doubt in this one after reading our pre-rec. I mean, after reading those four issues, I expected to like this, and I'm happy to report that I did. It wasn't a perfect issue, but I still very much enjoyed my time with it. Let's start off by sidestepping the weeds for a second, because you know how I love getting into the weeds, but we'll sidestep them for a moment and we will start things off by trying to tackle our cliffhanger. Wally West is dead. Again. Like again, maybe. Possibly. Hopefully not. It's definitely a statement sort of cliffhanger, which is the sort of thing we normally want to get at the end of a first issue. And since this is a DC comic and not a Marvel comic, it's less likely we're going to get, you know, at least one new number one on most every single book every single year. Now, the thing about this cliffhanger, which separates it from most, is that I actually have no idea where it's headed. And that's a rarity in comics, and that's another pleasant surprise. Now, is Wally dead for good? And of course, that's a for good with a Comic Sans asterisk next to it, because it's comics, nothing's for good. But is he dead for now? I honestly can't say. I don't know, since, you know, The Flash's own book is, for whatever stupid-ass reason, just about to be relaunched back to number one. We go back to legacy numbering to get to 800, and then we go back to one? I mean, who in the hell is making these decisions, and why? Like, what good does that... I'll stop. I haven't yet read Flash number 800. That one's pre-ordered, it's coming next month, right? That is the final issue under the legacy numbering. But I have seen the cover. And I have seen the cover copy, which reads, A Celebration of Wally West. Which, I don't know, gang, doesn't exactly bode well for our guy, does it? You know, I don't want to get too deep into, like, the wheels within wheels of the comics creation process, since all I can do is speculate. So we will, for now, just take it as it comes and wait for it to play out. In any event, I mean, it was a solid cliffhanger and, you know, the first beat in what hopefully turns out to be a fun little mystery story. That, well, hopefully doesn't involve Deathstroke or a Titans traitor, or both, though odds are it probably will. Fingers crossed it doesn't, I don't know. I will say, however, that I feel like if Wally had been featured a bit more in the Rise of the Underworld story, this ending would have maybe had a little bit more oomph, at least for me. Because I swear, by the time we got to these final pages, I'd almost forgotten that Wally was supposed to be part of the cast. He's been such a non-factor so far, relatively speaking. The other Titans have been far more front and center than Wally has been. Oh well, what are you going to do? With that cliffhanger covered, how about we step off the beaten path into the ubiquitous weeds, right? I ever tell you all why I kind of fell out of love with Marvel Comics back in the mid-2010s? Have I? I probably have. But for the uninitiated, and I guess as a refresher, here we go again. One of the primary reasons why I stopped reading Marvel, it's going to sound very shallow, but it was the way they were ham-handedly shoehorning S.H.I.E.L.D. into seemingly every single friggin' book in the line. In some cases, like the Indestructible Hulk, they pushed the titular characters into these half-ass supporting roles for friggin' S.H.I.E.L.D. It really got bad. I mean, it was bad enough when they were shoving the Avengers into, like, almost every single page of every single book in the line. I mean, if you weren't reading Marvel Comics around the time the Avengers movies were coming out, it was as though after every scene, no matter what book, we would need to, like, check in with the Avengers to get their reaction. You know, it's like, oh, Magneto crossed the street. What do we think about that? Well, what do you think, Cap? I don't know, Iron Man. Let's talk about Magneto crossing a street. And yes, I'm totally exaggerating, but, not by as much as you think. Now, around 2013, 2014 or so, I think it was one of the many Marvel Nows, it reached a point where, like, even the Avengers had to defer to Maria Hill and S.H.I.E.L.D. for no matter what they wanted to do. Like, it wouldn't have surprised me to learn that Cap needed her to sign off on whether or not he could flush a toilet. It got really, really bad. Now, of course, I can't speak for everybody, but personally, I didn't start and keep reading comics to see boring tales of bureaucracy and red tape. Nor do I need every third scene to take place in a darkened room, only aglow in the light of several dozen monitors. unfortunately, that's kind of where comics have been headed, and pretty much are at this point. I hated S.H.I.E.L.D. and felt that they robbed Marvel Comics of anything resembling fun. And I tell you, I'm really not a fan of Amanda Waller and company for the same reason. To the point where, like, I kind of started to glaze over. Like, I felt like I'm reading this comic, I'm really digging it, kind of getting lost in it. I mean, the art was fantastic, the story was great. Then, like a brick to the head, Amanda Waller, Peacemaker, and the U.S. government. Not something I need in my comics, not something I want in my comics, but it kind of just is what it is. And, you know, I can't blame the writing for it, so I won't. I'm not going to blame the writing, because this is clearly an edict from on high. Because if you checked out the Dawn of DC Primer freebie, well, you'd know that it is chock full of this Peacemaker-Waller tandem. Definitely has, like, the feeling of, like, a Marvelication of the DC line right now. You would almost think that Bendis was still here stinking up the joint. It's just a thing I guess I'm going to have to grin and bear if I want more, you know, contemporary Titan stories. And I mean, I could and probably eventually will go on, but let me try and draw a line under this whole not a fan of the Titans versus the U.S. government thing, or Titans with the U.S. government, or any Titans, Waller, Peacemaker deal. Moving on. I already spoke my piece on the big guns of the DC Universe sitting out a potential nuclear meltdown. And I mean, I don't want to get it sideways here. I didn't think this was a bad scene at all. I thought it was, you know, as far as first outings go, I hate using words like perfect, because in the age of the internet, it's a meaningless word now. But his first outings go was pretty close to perfect, right? I mean, it was a massive, potentially world-altering threat, and it gave each of our heroes the ability to flex a bit of muscle and show their stuff. You know, they expertly displayed that even their support roles, such as, like, getting civilians to safety, they are necessary to the overall unit of the Titans. You know, everybody has their strengths, and I feel like this scene really, really played into it. I think it was really well done. And in a vacuum, or if, like, we were to learn that the big guns were all nebulously off-planet or unavailable, I wouldn't bat an eye. But, of course, this is the DC Universe. This is a shared universe and a shared planet. And, you know, lizard brain engaged, I can't let go of the fact that, you know, the heavy hitters in the hero community would just kind of stand by for this. And I mean, this isn't something that's unique to this book. This happens in, like, there's so many comics now, so many world-altering threats that not everybody could be everywhere at once. Unless, of course, it's the Avengers back in the Marvel Now days, where they were literally everywhere at once. And like I said earlier, maybe this will become a story beat down the line, or maybe they'll never mention it again. It'll just be another case of me getting horribly fixated on something nobody else will give a second thought to, which is more likely. I don't know, when I saw this and concocted this stupid story in my head, I kind of got those pangs of the revelation that we got in the Jurgens Superman Lois and Clark series from the DC YOU era. And in that, if you haven't read it, I recommend it highly. But we found out that ever since the launch of the New 52, the real Superman was always there. He was always there just off panel, you know, watching over this world and universe of new heroes just in case he was needed. And I love that element because it felt very Superman to me. And I don't know, made the cold, attitudinal, edgy, aloof New 52 feel a little bit more like home, you know. Yeah, I'm definitely fixating. I apologize. So let me get my pencil out and draw another line under this bit. And I will mercifully take us to our wrap-up. Overall, minor quibbles aside, and of course these quibbles are mostly informed by my own current year comic cynicism, and a little bit of once bitten twice shy from 2010's Marvel, I did very, very much enjoy this, and I felt it was a really good first official outing for our new old team. My only worry at this point is that I'm going to wind up double dipping on the second issue, so I don't have to wait for my mail order copy to arrive next month. That's about as high a praise as I could give any book, wanting to read more of it and wanting to read it as quickly as possible. So that, my friends, is where we will leave it. Next episode might be Cyborg number one. A little peek behind the curtain here. Anytime I write up a post or record an episode or write up a script, I generally read the comic book twice. Especially if it's a modern comic, since, you know, they tend to be a little bit breezier than the older stuff. So I think it's easier to miss out on details. And hell, I might have missed out on several details in this issue, even though I did read it, I think, three times. So I tend to read the books twice just to make sure I don't miss anything, even, you know, as dense as I am. I usually pick up something extra on the second read-through. Thus far, I've read Cyborg 1 once. Didn't really care for it. I'm gonna give it a second read-through. Hopefully, I'll receive it a little bit better and maybe be able to put together a piece on it. I don't want to make any promises. I'm trying not to force this. You know, I think with X-Lapsed, I fell into that trap where no matter how good or bad a story was, it was about putting the content out, right? So we read through X-Men Green. You know, we read through X-Corp. You know, books that probably weren't worth the time and definitely weren't worth the frustration. So I'm going to give Cyborg another look. Maybe we'll do a show on it. Maybe we won't. That, of course, doesn't mean we can't discuss it. If anybody has read it or is thinking about reading it and wants to discuss any part of it, please feel free to write in. And, of course, if you read Titans number one, or if you're inspired to, or if you're inspired not to, you know, let me know your thoughts. You could find me all the usual ways. Chris is on infiniteearths.com, weirdcomicshistory@gmail.com. Don't feel obligated, but of course, I am pretty easy to find that way. Anyway, with all that said, let's wrap things up here. I'd like to thank you all so much for choosing to spend a little bit of your day with me today. And until next time, fingers crossed, I'll talk to you again real soon. See ya. Still.